we're going to see, and it's amazing how God weaves together His Word. Basically, we're going to see Israel take what Tom was reminding us of in the sermon today, that God is good, and God is a gracious Father who gives us all that we need, and Israel says, we're not so sure about that. And as a result of that, they complain. They reject what God has done for them. The book of Numbers, as we begin a number of weeks in that book, is called Numbers because of the numbering of the people that takes place in there, in chapter 1 and elsewhere, that God is preparing the people to go into the land. You remember where we've been? They came out of the Exodus around 1445 B.C. We're at Mount Sinai for about a month there, and then a month in Leviticus, where they received instructions for the tabernacle, received the law, and then camped there during the time when Leviticus was given to them. And Numbers records the transition from the generation that came out of the Exodus to the generation who will actually go in to the promised land. The generation that came out of the Exodus failed to trust God, and as a result spent about 39 years wandering through the wilderness. And so the first part of Numbers chapter 1 through 10 is really God preparing that generation that came out of the Exodus to enter the promised land. It's the preparation of that generation, and it's just a brief period of time as they leave Mount Sinai at the end of Leviticus, first part of Numbers. They are numbered, they're given roles, they're organized, they celebrate the Passover on that year after they had come out of the Exodus. And then in Numbers chapter 10, there's a transition point in verse 11 where they are ready to leave. It says, "In the second year, on the second month, on the 20th of the month, the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. They moved," in verse 13, "for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses." So they've been at Mount Sinai preparing to go into the land. God moves them through the cloud, leading them. And the intent is, we are going from Sinai to the promised land. Chapters 11 through 25 of Numbers record the failure of that generation to enter the land. The bulk of Numbers is how that generation did not trust God and therefore did not go into the land. The last part of Numbers is then the preparation of the new generation to go into the land, and that carries over into the book of Deuteronomy prior to them heading in. Our focus is going to be on that middle section of Numbers, looking at the failure of that generation, their lack of faith. You know, Numbers is a book, if you've been in Men of the Word, you memorize the theme of wilderness wandering. That's what happens. The lesson of Numbers, I think, is more related to trusting God, towards faith in God. One author says, "Numbers teaches the important lesson that biblical faith requires trusting God against appearances." We're going to see that very clearly next week. And we see the beginnings of that this week in the people's lack of confidence, lack of trust in God as they begin to complain. Look at chapter 11 in verse 1. It's been a little over a year of the people out having left Egypt, and it says this: "Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when the Lord heard it, His anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of the camp. And the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died out. And the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them." This is just a general introduction to the complaining of the people. We don't know what they were complaining about specifically. God burned the outsides of the camp. Some people were consumed in that, but they didn't learn their lesson. We're going to see three examples of the complaints of the people over the rest of chapter 11 and chapter 12. And I'm going to think about them with you in kind of two categories. The first is their complaining about their circumstances, And the second is they're complaining about people. You know, I think those are probably the two typical categories of life that we complain about or that our children or grandchildren complain about, right? We could fit most things that we complain about into one of those two things. Either it's our circumstances, the things we have, the things we don't have, the trials we're going through, or it's complaining about people, about the people in our life that God has brought. And we're going to start in chapter 11 first and see the people complaining about their circumstances. Look at chapter 11, verse 4. First thing we're going to see is the root of their complaints. Why were they complaining? Verse 4 says, the rabble who were among them. That's a word that kind of a phrase that means a mixed multitude. It's probably referring to people who had come out of Egypt with Israel. There were some from Egypt who, when God did all that He did, they said, hey, we'd rather stick with the Israelites than with the Egyptians. And so there were some who were not Jews who had left and essentially identified themselves with Israel. And it's these who start the grumbling. It says they were among them who had greedy desires. They longed for something that they wanted. They were greedy. And the sons of Israel also joined in, wept again, and said, who will give us meat to eat? Did a year in the wilderness. They came out with flocks and herds. Probably much of that had been used up in their time in the wilderness, or they at least didn't have enough to have all the meat that they wanted to have. In verse 5, they say, we remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic, but now our appetite is gone. They think back to their time in Egypt, where they lived in Egypt was a very fertile area, lots of those vegetables, lots of water to grow different things, lots of meat and fish. And they say, oh, remember the good old days back in Egypt. Pretty messed up perspective, isn't it? And they say, now our appetite is gone. We're withering away. There is nothing at all to look at except this manna. What's going on in their hearts? They want something, don't they? They want something they remember they used to have. They've certainly shaped their thinking in a particular way to forget a lot of other things that came. Yeah, you want cucumbers? Great. All you have to be is slaves in Egypt and you can have some. They've kind of taken the worst memories and blocked those out and said, oh man, we just ate fish all the time. You know, in between making bricks, we had all the fish we could eat. It was great. Because their heart longed for something, wanted something that they did not have, meat and the foods that they had eaten while they were there. Now, in Numbers verse 7 through 9, we're told a little more about manna. The picture that the people are painting about their manna is, oh, it's just like, you know, it's like white bread every day. All we get is white bread every day, and we just wish we had something else. God says, no, that's not really the case. It says in verse 7, manna was like a coriander seed, and its appearance was like that of delium. That clarifies it for us, right? You got it now. But it says the people would go about and gather it and grind it between two millstones, or beat it in the mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it, and its taste was as the taste of cakes baked with oil. It had an olive oil flavor. It's said elsewhere that it tasted kind of like honey. And so this was not all bad. This was an amazing provision that God had made to give them manna. They could take it and grind it up, use it like flour. If all you have is flour, you can still do all kinds of different things with it. It's not like you're eating white bread only every day. It was a very useful, gracious thing that God had provided for them. So they're complaining because they have a craving, a desire for something. That's typically why we complain in our circumstances, isn't it? It's because we want something. It may be something that we used to have that now we don't. It may be something different. Usually it's that the circumstances we have now are not what we want them to be. And we have focused on how bad what we have now is, even when it's usually not as bad as we think it is. But we are so focused on a desire of our heart. We've got to have that, and we're not going to be content without it. And notice the complaining spreads. Isn't that how it works? It went from the rabble, the sons of Israel. In verse 10, it says Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families. It's basically everybody. It's spreading. This grumbling and complaining attitude is spreading like wildfire all throughout the people of Israel. Isn't that how complaining works? You know, we don't even know something's bad until somebody else says something that, and now it's like, oh yeah, I never thought of it. Man, yeah, I love that. I can't believe we don't, you know, that's how commercials work. It's like you didn't even know you needed that until you saw it on a commercial, and now you've got to have it. And you know, 3 minutes ago, you didn't even know it existed. Life was totally fine, but not anymore. Oh yeah, I forgot about that. We could get that. Guys, is that not us and our hearts and our kids' hearts? It just spreads. This lack of gratitude, this focus on what we want that we don't have, that's what's going on for them. Well, God gives a little glimpse of manna there, and then we get a scene change to Moses. We're going to come back in detail to this in just a second and see Moses complaining about the people. But basically, let's just read it and walk through it briefly, and then we'll come back to it a little bit. It says, "Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, each man at the doorway of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly." What's God's response to their complaining? He's angry. Is it just that it's annoying to him, like our children when they whine about something and it just kind of grates at us? No. It's that God has been gracious. God has been good. God has done far more than they deserve. He has done everything that they needed, and yet here they are saying, well, it's not enough. God has every right to be angry with them. And Moses, it says, was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you been so hard on your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all this people on me?" What's Moses complaining about? Not the manna. He's complaining about the people. Right? Why did you put all these people in my life? And we'll come back to that in a bit. So the Lord says to Moses in verse 16, "Gather for me 70 elders." We'll come back and look a little bit more at that in just a bit. In verse 18, it says, "Consecrate yourself, for tomorrow you shall eat meat." God says, "You have wept in the ears of the Lord, saying, oh, that someone would give us meat to eat, for we were well off in Egypt." How about a joke, right? "Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat," verse 19, "not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept bitterly before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt?" God says, you want meat? Okay. I'll give you meat. I'm not going to give you like a snack of meat. I'm not going to supplement your manna with meat. You want meat? Okay. You got it. Not 1 day's worth, not 2 days worth, not a week's worth, not 20 days worth. You get meat for a month until the last thing you ever want to see is meat. Because God gave them what they wanted. It's amazing. God says, okay, you're going to complain, you're going to whine, I'm going to give you what you want. Realize that God gives us our desires sometimes in really discipline or judgment. So we see in Romans chapter 1 of man's wickedness, God says his judgment is he gives men over to the desires of their hearts. He says, okay, you want that? It's not good for you. It's not best for you. I've already given you what is best and told you what is good. Encourage you to be content with what is good. You want it. You got it. And you're going to live with it. Guys, I think God does that for us sometimes. You want to pursue all that you can pursue in your career and earn all you can do? Okay, you'll get that promotion. And you're going to live with it. And everything that goes with it. Guys, God does not always withhold our desires from us. Sometimes He gives them to us, which is discipline for us. You've got to be careful. And so it says down in verse 31 that there went forth a wind from the Lord and it brought quail from the sea. Usually there would be some quail that come in from towards the sea, different times of year. This was a miraculous display. He brought quail from the sea and he let them fall beside the camp. about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around camp, about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. God had already provided quail for them once back in Exodus chapter 16 when they had complained in a similar way. This time he gives them a whole lot of it. It's described by the breadth of its distribution, by the depth of the piles and how much each person got. It says, if you went a day's journey, maybe 12, 15 miles out of camp, there's a whole lot of quail. Any direction, there's quail. He says it was a couple of cubits deep on the surface of the ground. Some think that was how low they were flying, just a couple feet off the ground so that they could capture, but I don't think so. I think it describes it as he brought them and they fell besides the camp. This is a whole lot of quail. This is an amazing amount. I mean, this is up to your knees or higher, quail for 12 miles all around. God says, okay, you want meat? Here you go. Have some. And the people, what'd they do? You know, they spent all day and all night and all the next day and they gathered the quail. They still don't get it. They still think, all right, we got what we wanted. This is great. Look at all these quail. And they gathered them all up. It says, he who gathered least gathered 10 homers, which was a lot of quail. And they spread them out for themselves. They took all that meat and they prepared it, salted it, probably were drying it out so that it would last so they could have meat because they wanted meat. Tons and tons of quail meat. And it says, while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people, and he struck the people with a very severe plague. Psalm 78 describes this account that some of the stoutest of men died from possibly the food poisoning that came with that, or whatever it was that God did. And the name of that place was called Kibroth Hathaavah, because there they buried the people who had been greedy. He says, look, I'll give you what you want, but there are consequences for that because you have rejected my goodness. As the remedy for complaining about our circumstances, it starts with our own desires, doesn't it? That's the emphasis here. Back in chapter 11, verse 4, it starts off with their desires. It concludes the end of chapter 11. They named the place, basically, we were greedy here. Our desires. The issue was they wanted something, and they wanted it so badly that they complained and grumbled about it and demanded it of God. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 real quick. 1 Corinthians 10. It describes these events and others that took place for Israel in the wilderness. And in verse 6 it says, these things happened as examples for us so that we would not crave evil things as they also crave. Specifically talking there about the idolatry and probably the golden calf incident. But it says, we're not to be idolaters as some of them were. Verse 10, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. These things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction upon whom the ends of the ages has come. It says, these things are an example for us, a reminder that we should not crave, we should not long for those evil things that they did. Now, sometimes we long for and we desire things that are in and of themselves sinful, don't we? We can desire things that are wrong. You know, we can desire a sexual relationship that God has expressly forbidden, and that is wicked to desire that. Sometimes, though, what we see here with them is we just desire things more than we should. It's not that what we want is bad. It's that we want it more than we should want it. It wasn't anything wrong with meat, per se, but it was how badly they wanted it and how much they wanted it and that they were willing to sin to get it and they were grumbling and complaining when they didn't have it. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, this is a reminder to us be careful what we want, what your heart wants. Because when you and I start grumbling and complaining about our circumstances, even just in small ways, you know, subtle things, when we start talking, you know, with a lack of gratitude for the house we have, or the car we have, or the clothes we have, or the food we eat, or the wife we have, or the kids we have, or the whatever it is, the root going on is our hearts are desiring something more than they should. And he says in 1 Corinthians 10, let him who stands, who thinks he stands, take heed that he doesn't fall. Mind us, we're all prone to this. There's not one of us who is not prone to love things more than we should love, to want things more than we should want them. And complaining is a great picture, it's a great reminder that our hearts are there, that we want something more than we should. Instead, we're to be content. Paul in Philippians chapter 4 describes this attitude when he says in verse 11, Paul says, I don't speak from want, for I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, in prosperity, and any and every circumstance I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Paul says, I've learned that if I've got manna for a year, I'm okay with that. God gives me quail every now and then, so be it. I'll be thankful for it. But I've learned to be content because of the strength that Christ provides for me. That's the strength of Christ. It's not that, hey, I can, you know, I'm a little guy and I can bench press 400 pounds because of the strength of Christ. No, it's that I can be content in whatever circumstances He places me in by the strength that He gives me. And I think prior to this, Paul outlines some really key attitudes that allowed Paul to say this. Like in verse 4, he says, rejoice in the Lord always. Why was Paul content? Because he was joyful. He was focused on the goodness of God and what God was doing, even in hard circumstances. Verse 6, he was anxious for nothing. He didn't sit around worrying about what it was that God was going to provide for him. He knew God was in control of those things. And he brought things to God in prayer, in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your request be made known to God. It's not wrong to come to God and ask for something. What do you think God's response would have been had the people come to God humbly and said, God, we are so thankful for your provision. You have been amazingly kind to us. You have provided manna for us and such a powerful picture of your provision for us. And God, we would love some meat too. You know, could you in your kindness at some point give us just a bit of variety? We would be grateful for that. What do you think God would have done? Well, according to our lesson this morning, God's kind, isn't He? And He probably would have said, yeah, have some meat. I'm not going to give you tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of meat until it comes out of your nostrils and you hate it. But yeah, I'm kind to you in those ways. Gracious in that way. He might not. He might have said, I want you to wait another year. Then I'll give you some meat. He might have said, I want you to wait till you get into the land. And you'll have all kinds of things and you will appreciate it far more than what you have now because of what you've been through. But that wasn't the people's attitude. The people's attitude was, we want meat. Paul says, no, be content, rejoice, be thankful. Come to God humbly with gratitude for what He's done, knowing that you can trust Him in the midst of that. Verse 8, think about what's true, whatever's honorable, whatever's right. What's the people's problem? They started to think about all kinds of things that weren't true. They had this fake picture in their mind of what Egypt was like. And so they were discontent in those ways. So the remedy for our complaints is to deal with our cravings, to recognize we long for things, we're greedy, we desire things. Sometimes it's very simple things, like peace and quiet when our kids want something and we don't want to give it to them, and it's because I'm greedy and I'm selfish and I just want what I want. Sometimes we want better things or nicer things. We're envious of others. It's a heart attitude that we need to deal with. And we need to foster a spirit of contentment, rejoicing in what God's done, praying and thanking God for what He's given us, humbly asking Him for other things that we would desire, but trusting Him. People complained, and God said, okay, I'll give you what you want, but it will be an act of discipline for you. We also see not only complaints about circumstances, we see a complaint about people. And this is powerful and convicting. Look back at Moses' response again. What's going on in Moses' heart? In verse 10 of chapter 11, it says, Moses heard the people weeping. Anger was kindled. Moses was displeased. And Moses says, "Why?" Listen to the pronouns here. Why have you been so hard on your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all this people on me? Was it I who conceived all this people? Was it I who brought them forth that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing infant to the land which you swore to their fathers? Why am I to get meat? Where am I to get meat to give all this people? For they weep before me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. I alone am not able to carry all this people because it is too burdensome for me. So if you are going to deal thus with me, please kill me at once if I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. What's going on in Moses' heart? He's burdened, isn't he? He's burdened by his position of leadership that God's put him in. Moses is blaming God, isn't he? You see the pronouns? You did this. It's like Eve in the garden and Adam in the garden saying, hey God, you did this. It's that blame shifting that sinners do. It's not my fault I'm struggling here. God, it's your fault. You did this. And notice that Moses totally removes himself from the people. It's not we are struggling in the wilderness. It's they are. This is different. When Moses was interceding for the people after the golden calf incident, remember he identified with them. Here, Moses is saying, I'm not like them. Why have you given these wretched people to me and to me alone to carry throughout the wilderness? Because I would suggest that when you and I complain about people, oftentimes they are people that we have some responsibility for or involvement with because of the position that we're in. You ever complain about your kids? You ever think complaining thoughts about your kids? You ever burdened by that position? God, why'd you give me these kids? It's your idea. God, you are the one who is sovereign over these things. Why would you give me these particular kinds of kids? You know their personality just doesn't go with mine. And there's conflict there. What were you thinking, God, in doing this to me? You probably don't say that too often, too loud. But we think that way, don't we? We subtly think, maybe it's at work. Why are these people that I have to work with? Why are these people that I have to oversee? Yes, Moses, first off, I think, forgot that he was like them. Forgot he's one of them. He's thinking, God, it's like you and me and them. And God's perspective is, no, it's me and it's all of you. And you're one of them. You're just like them, Moses. You are a sinner. You're prone to those things. When we get burdened by our position, when we complain about other people, our kids, co-workers, we are oftentimes forgetting, I think, just like Moses did, that we're like them. Those things that bug us about our kids are true of us. That's where they learn them most of the time, unfortunately. You know, we are seeing ourselves in a mirror in our kids. We're just like them. Maybe not in every way, not to the same extremes. But don't forget, we're just like them. We are sinners ourselves. And Moses also felt he had to do it alone, didn't he? I mean, think about what he's saying to God. And God, did you really give them to me on my own? I have to carry these people throughout the wilderness. Is that what's been going on? No, where are they getting the manna? From Moses? No. God. Who did the plagues? God. Who parted the Red Sea? God. Who's done everything in this? God. And yet Moses has this, woe is me, I alone am trying to do this on my own. You ever feel that way? As a parent? That's all about me. That fosters complaints about others, doesn't it? When we feel like, hey, I'm different from them. I don't struggle in these ways. When we feel like I'm all alone in trying to do this, it fosters this. That's where Moses is. We see another example of complaining about people over in chapter 12. We'll come back and look more at God's response to Moses. But look over at chapter 12. We see a different scenario. Moses was burdened by his position. In chapter 12, we see Miriam and Aaron, who are really jealous of others' position. That's often why we complain. It's because of the position we're in. God, I don't want to have to do what you've called me to do with the people who are difficult to work with in my life. Or we say, I don't like the person who's in a position that I'm not in, and I'm going to complain about them. That's what Miriam and Aaron do. Notice verse chapter 12, verse 1. It says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. Now, it's clear here that Miriam is the leader of this. The word for speaking in the context here is used of a feminine, singular person. So Miriam is the instigator here, bringing Aaron along with her. And they come up with this great idea of how to speak against Moses. They say, hey, Moses married a Cushite, not an Israelite. Now, we don't know for sure if this was Zipporah, Moses' wife, or if she had died and he married a new wife who was a Cushite. There's different people who think different ways, and there's some good reasons for either perspective. But why do you think Miriam and Aaron came up with this excuse against Moses in the context here? Moses has married a foreigner. This is not good, is their perspective. Why are they thinking that way now? Who started the grumbling back in chapter 11? It was the foreigners, right? It was that mixed multitude. And so I think Aaron and Miriam have probably, particularly Miriam, has had this kind of resentment towards Moses. And I think this incident of the grumbling instigated by the foreigners in their midst that had started that, I think was their kind of, her kind of opening to say, ooh, yeah, and Moses has married a foreigner. Let's complain about Moses because he's married a foreigner. And so they come with this complaint against him. But what's really going on? Are they really upset that Moses married a foreigner? Now, look at verse 2. It says, and they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? And the Lord heard it. So what they're claiming is their complaint is that, hey, Moses has married a foreigner. And we think that kind of undermines his leadership. Maybe we need to expand the leadership team here because Moses is not, he's been influenced by his Cushite wife. What's really going on is they're saying, hey, we're jealous. God has spoken through us too. Why is Moses the guy? Why is Moses the one who gets to lead everybody? Why is Moses the one that God speaks through? He's done that through us before, and he had. But his normal way of communicating to Israel was through Moses. And so Miriam and Aaron, particularly Miriam, are jealous. And notice what they do. They come up with a reason, an excuse, to complain about Moses that they think will get some sympathy. They think the people might say, oh, you're right, those foreigners started complaining, and Moses has a foreign wife, so yeah, we should give you guys more authority here. I think they're even hoping that God would be sympathetic to them, that God would say, oh, you're right, it's a foreigner, we got to be careful, we should be careful with this. Isn't that how it works for us? It's easy to be hard on Moses or Aaron and Miriam and to say, how dare they? Isn't that how it works for us? If you're honest, and if I'm honest, much of the time, maybe not every time, much of the time when we complain about others who are in a different role than us, could be a wife complaining about a husband or a husband complaining about a wife, could be an employee complaining about a boss or even a boss complaining about an employee to a degree. Much of the time we come up with something that we think, hey, this will sound good, maybe even spiritual. You know, we don't want Moses to be influenced by the foreign wife. But what's going on in our hearts? Usually, jealousy, isn't it? It's usually that I wish I was them. I wish I had whatever they have. Maybe not fully. Maybe we look at the guy who works under us and we say, I wish I didn't have the stress like he doesn't have, and I'm going to complain about him because it makes me feel better that I have to deal with these things. Maybe it's the other way around. We complain about the boss because we are jealous of the authority that he has and the benefits that come with it. Same with our spouse. You guys, but our hearts, here's what I want you to see. Our hearts, just like Miriam and Aaron, we don't want to just come out and say, hey, I'm jealous of them. We come up with all kinds of other little things that we can complain and grumble about. But the heart issue is most often jealousy. And if we're going to deal with our grumbling and complaining, we got to deal with the jealous heart, the desires, again, that we have. Our sin is subtle like that. It's deceitful like that. We can so quickly convince ourselves that we have a legitimate reason to be complaining about so-and-so who's in a different position than us, when most of the time we're just jealous of something their role gives them, of the role in general, of their authority, their position, whatever it is. That's what's going on. They're jealous. And they're coming up with things to grumble about. Again, that doesn't mean there's not times where it's right to talk about the thing that your boss does that's not appropriate, and to go and address that in the right way, or to talk to your spouse or those things. There are times to do that, but this is obviously the wrong way to go about it. What's the response to their complaints? It's interesting. There's two different responses here. To Moses, you know what God says back in verse 16 of chapter 11? To Moses, God gives grace and help. He rebukes him a little bit too, but his primary response is grace and help. Look at verse 16. The Lord said to Moses, okay, gather for me 70 men from the elders of Israel, whom you know to be elders of the people and their officers, and bring them to the tent of meeting and take their stand, and let them take their stand there with you. And when I come down, I will speak with you there, and I will take up the Spirit who is upon you, and I will put him upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you will not bear it alone. God says, okay, you're feeling overwhelmed, you feel like you're all alone, I'm going to give you help. Moses is still complaining. God could have said, get over it, buddy, I'm here and I'm doing it. And you are just the human vehicle. But God says, no, I'm going to have compassion on you, and I'm going to give you the help that you need. I don't think this is like the meat. God is not saying, okay, you want help? I'm going to give you help. I'm not going to give you one guy. I'm going to give you 70. And you're stuck with a committee of 70 now. I don't think that's God's heart. I think God is genuinely saying, okay, I'm going to be gracious to you, and I'm going to give you the help that you need in this. God often responds this way to those who are seeking to be spiritual leaders and who are struggling. This gives great hope to me, and I hope it does to you. You know, as a pastor, just as a dad, as one who seeks to influence others spiritually, God is very gracious to those who are seeking to do that role and seeking to do it well, but who are struggling. You think of like Elijah when or Jeremiah, when they're struggling. God, woe is me. They say something similar to what Moses said. I just wish I was dead. I can't do this. God's compassionate. God meets their physical needs. He helps them. He brings along encouragement. Reminds them of those things. That's God's heart. Because if you're struggling with the burden of whatever role God's placed you in, God desires, and He will give you the grace and the help to fulfill that in a way that would please Him. Sometimes that means others come alongside and help you. Sometimes it just means you cry out for the wisdom and the grace, as Tom's been talking about it, and God gives that to you because He delights in seeing you fulfill that role. So these 70 guys come. Moses gathers the congregation. Just back in verse 21, we skipped over this earlier. I love this part. He tells them he's going to give them meat. Moses still didn't get it in verse 21. Moses said, the people among whom I am are 600,000 on foot. Those are the men that have been numbered. Yet you've said, I will give them meat so that they may eat for a whole month. Should flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to be sufficient for them? Or should all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to be sufficient for them? Moses says, how on earth are we going to give these people meat for a month? There's a whole lot of them. There's like 2 million if you take all the men and women and children. And God says, is the Lord's power limited? You shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. God reminds, He gives Moses help, and He reminds Moses that, hey, my power is unlimited. It's part of the grace that he gives Moses. I think one reason why God gave them so much meat may have been for the encouragement of Moses. To say, look, if I want to give the people meat, I can do it. You don't have to worry about it, buddy. You don't have to feel overwhelmed by this. When I want to do something, I got it. You don't need to feel the weight of it. My arm is plenty long. My power is not limited. And so Moses went out, told the people the words, gathered the 70 men, verse 25, then the Lord came down in a cloud, spoke to him, took the spirit that was upon him, and placed him upon the 70 elders. It wasn't that God was taking the spirit from Moses, he was giving the same spirit to them. And they prophesied, it says, but they did not do it again. This is what we see throughout Scripture. When the Spirit of God comes upon a new group of people, there's often an initial display of that. That's what's going on here. We don't have time to get into it, but it's very similar to what you see in Acts, where there was speaking in tongues when the gospel was spreading to new groups of people. And it didn't happen forever. It was a one-time deal that said, okay, this is legitimate. The Spirit is on these guys. You don't ever have to wonder about that anymore. They're not going to keep prophesying, but this is the sign of that. That's what's going on here. And verse 26, we see the same principle we've been talking about. Two of the men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, the name of the other Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them. We don't know why they were in camp. Maybe they were sick. Who knows? And they were among those who had been registered but had not gone out. So 68 of the guys went out. These two guys are hanging back for whatever reason. And they prophesied in the tent. And verse 27 says, a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the attendant of Moses from his youth, said, Moses, my Lord, restrain them. They're kind of complaining about these people, aren't they? They're saying, hey, there's two guys who aren't supposed to be prophesying. They're not here with everybody else. And they're prophesying. And Moses hits on the heart attitude there. Again, he says in verse 29, Moses said to him, are you jealous for my sake? You don't need to be jealous. It's okay. Would that all the Lord's people were prophets. So God responds to Moses, who is burdened by his position, by the role that God has placed him in of shepherding and leading these people. And God says, I'm going to give you grace and I'm going to give you help. I've got a plan to bring alongside others who can be a resource to you. I'm going to show my power to you so that you know that it is not all on you to do this. God responds very differently to Miriam and Aaron. Look at verse chapter 12 again. Verse 4. Actually, pick back up in verse 2. They said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well? And the Lord heard it. Now verse 3, we have, now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. This is just put in there as a side note to know that Moses was not flaunting his position. Some people say, hey, wait a minute, didn't Moses write this? How could the most humble man on the earth write that he was the most humble man on the earth? Wouldn't that kind of disqualify you from being the most humble man on the earth if you go around talking about how humble you are? I think Joshua wrote obviously a little bit of the Pentateuch, records Moses' death and things that most likely Joshua. So it's possible that this was a editorial comment that Moses himself did not add, that another author added, and that would be fine. Or it's possible that Moses, under the inspiration of the Spirit, this is what God wanted written, and so he wrote it. So verse 4, notice God's response. God doesn't come to them and say, oh yeah, you're right. Let me add you to the inner circle. You can be a part of the executive committee too, and it'll be great. No, suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, you three come out to the tent of meeting. So the three of them came out. This is bad, right? This is like when my kids are playing outside and dad sees them doing something and dad walks out and said, hey, come, you three, come inside right now. It's like, ooh, what's going on? That's what's going on here. So the three of them came out and the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent and he called Aaron and Miriam. Oh, this is even worse, right? There's three of them there, and God says, hey, you two. What do we do? And look what God says. God says, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. He says, hey, when I have a prophet, I speak through him in a vision or a dream. He speaks on my behalf. But he says, hey, not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly and not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. He says, look, Moses is not even just a normal prophet here, guys. Moses is my friend. I speak face to face with Moses. I have a relationship with Moses that, yeah, you may have prophesied once or twice. You're not in the role that Moses is in. He says, why then, verse 8, were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? You should have been terrified to say anything negative about my guy here that I put in this role. And the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. This was not a conversation. This was God lecturing them. I mean, this is God telling them, this is wrong. He rebukes them. God rebukes them very powerfully, and then he humbles them. Look at what happens then. It says, when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. And Aaron turned toward Miriam. Behold, she was leprous. Again, this is just evidence that I think Aaron was just kind of going along for the ride. This was really Miriam. You know, Aaron was the high priest, so he had a more visible role. I think Miriam was the one struggling primarily with jealousy. And as soon as Aaron turned towards her, she was leprous. And Aaron said to Moses, oh, my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us in which we have acted foolishly and in which we have sinned. He acknowledges, you're right, God. That was wrong of us. We had a terrible perspective. Instead of being thankful for Moses, for what you're doing through him, we were jealous of him. We sinned. And he says in verse 12, oh, do not let her be like one dead whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes from his mother's womb. Says Moses, please help her. You know, again, if I was Moses, I might say, yeah, think about it. Get back to you. Moses' initial response, he cried out to the Lord, saying, oh God, heal her, I pray. And he's a humble man, isn't he? He's learned, I'm just like them. Maybe he's thinking about the fact that, yeah, I didn't complain against Moses. I am Moses, but I complained about the people, and I was kind of feeling bad about what you called me to do. I'm just like you. And so he intercedes on her behalf. And the Lord, in verse 14, gives grace, but he also allows enduring consequences. He says, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? So referring back to some of the uncleanness that we saw briefly in Leviticus. He says, if something else happened to her, very simple, she would still be unclean for 7 days. He says, let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterwards she may be received again. So Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on until Miriam was received again. Afterward, they moved on from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. God rebuked him, and he humbled him, particularly Miriam. She had to live outside of camp as a leper for 7 days, unclean. The whole camp waited for her for those 7 days before they moved on. Yes, God responded differently, didn't he, to Moses and to Miriam and Aaron. And I think there is an encouragement in that for us, that there are times we're burdened by the role God's placed us in, and God understands that, and he longs to help us in that. And we need to keep the right perspective, but God is gracious. But there are times where we are just sinfully jealous. You know, and we have a wicked heart. And God says, I'm going to do what's good for you. I'm going to rebuke you, and I'm going to humble you. In both cases, he gives us what we need. But what we need is very different depending on our hearts. And we don't have to know which ones need which. God does that in his kindness. He gives us what we need. He gave Israel exactly what they needed, a lesson in trusting him. He needed to teach them not to grumble and complain, because they're going to be in the wilderness for a long time, and God's equipping them for that. he's equipping them to be grateful in the promised land, as we'll see later on in Deuteronomy. So what's the remedy for our complaints about people? Particularly, as we've been talking about, people that we have authority over, that we are responsible for, people that our position necessitates interacting with, or for those who are in other positions, who are in authority over us. You know, we're reminded, God says, hey, I put Moses, Moses is my guy, he's right where I need him to be, I have the exact relationship with him I want to have with him, and it's different than you. We need to first recognize God's sovereignty in establishing authority. Romans 13:1 tells us that there is no authority except from God. Moses was in that role because God wanted him there. Miriam was not in that role because God didn't want her there. And she had to be reminded, this is okay. It's what God has planned. As you may be the boss, you may not be the boss, but you are right where you need to be according to God's plan. In your family, you are the wife or you are the husband, and you are in that role according to God's plan. Maybe that your personality would be much better equipped for the other role, but God says, nope, you are right where I want you to be. We need to recognize God has put us there when we're burdened by that, when we're overwhelmed by it. We need to say, God, you've placed me here. You will give me the grace, the help that I need to do this. Or, God, you've not placed me in that role. You've placed somebody else in that role. And I'm going to trust you. Because when I complain against that person, I am really complaining against God. We need to appreciate and honor those in authority over us. 1 Thessalonians 5:12-13 talks about we appreciate those who or to appreciate those who diligently labor among us and have charge over us. Miriam and Aaron lost sight of that, didn't they? The people lost sight of God's faithful care of them. And we need to identify with those we are in authority over. You're frustrated with your kids? Don't forget, we're just like them. We may be more cultured in how we express our selfishness. We may not pull hair when we don't get what we want, but we're selfish. And instead of it being us complaining about you, it needs to be us recognizing we're in the same boat as them, and our hope is Christ, what God has done. So this week, when you hear complaining, when you complain, diagnose the heart issue. What's going on? What do you want so badly that God has chosen to withhold from you? Why are you jealous of them or thinking only about yourself and your resources? Remember God's response. He may give you what you want. Act of discipline. He offers you help and grace to fulfill the role that He's called you to. He may humble you to remind you of those things and seek to be content. Be thankful this week. Be thankful for the circumstances and the people that God's brought into your life. And know that God is using those to accomplish His good purpose. As Tom told us, remind us this morning, God is our Father. He gives good things, not only when we ask Him, but in all of the gifts that He has given us, they are for our good. Let's be grateful, not complaining, by God's grace this week. Let's pray. Father, we thank You for this powerful picture of our own sinful hearts. Lord, we all struggle in these ways. We struggle to complain about our circumstances. We want things that You've withheld from us. We want things that we used to have that we don't have anymore. We even want good things, but we want them more than we should. Lord, we complain about people. We see the faults of others. We are jealous of the authority of others. We feel overwhelmed by the responsibility You've given us over others. I pray You'd humble us, that You would remind us of Your gracious, sovereign control, that You give good things. And Lord, if we have something, it is a gift from You, and if You have chosen to withhold it, You have done so for our good. Lord, give us thankful hearts this week. Help us to remember all the ways You have been kind to us, to focus on those. Lord, we thank You in Christ's name.